This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 23 for Thursday, September 3rd, 2009. Thus spake David E. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at outoflinedetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours Greenwich Mean Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line After Hours in the iTunes Music Store.
Welcome to another episode of Out of Line After Hours, and welcome to our studio here. Joining me as always every week, Mr. Auto Extremist, my pal, Peter DeLorenzo. Peter, great having you here.
John, good to see you. It's only been 24 hours since I last saw you.
Yeah, because we did have lunch yesterday.
Yes.
Yeah.
We had a business meeting. It was good.
It was good. And I liked your column this week, too. You were really picking on car companies not doing things the right way, but especially BMW, I think, was one that...
Well, they've got this efficient dynamics thing rolling now.
This new concept car that they're going to...
Well, it's also a new direction for the company. It doesn't quite roll off the tongue like Ultimate Driving Machine.
Right.
And they're a little late to the party. You know, Audi is well out front with this alternative fuel and vision thing. And so BMW is sort of... They're putting the stake in the ground in the green... In the shiny, happy Green Valley, but I don't. It's a work in progress, no doubt.
They've come out with some curious products lately, too, that just seems like they're just trying to throw stuff out there to see if it works or not. It doesn't seem as well-focused as they've been in the past.
Yeah, and, well, we've talked about the X6 and this new 5 Series GT. Of course, Honda's doing that, whatever they're calling that...
The Cross Tour?
Yeah, the Cross Tour.
And yeah, we can talk about that later.
Yeah, okay.
Whoa, does that have... it got hit with the ugly stick, I think.
Yeah.
And we also have in our studio with us this evening David E. Davis, Jr. David, welcome to...
Thank you.
Joining us
you.
At Out of Line After Hours.
Always good to be in these friendly surroundings.
So what are you doing these days?
Well, I am filling in the holes in my personal income doing a book about a wonderful guy named Bud Lyon, who is a big car collector and scientist, engineer, mathematician. He's led an astonishing life, had an astonishing career, and sort of the culmination of that career was that he and two fellow engineers started a company called APCC. And if you look under your desktop, you'll see all kinds of APC equipment under there on the ancillaries. And he sold it 2 years ago for $6.1 billion.
That's real money.
Schneider people in France, Schneider Electric, bought it and paid $6.1 billion for it. And he's...
So I hope you socked him up for a whopping big book writing fee.
I didn't get enough. How do you like that? Yeah, as the... what was it? Archie and Mehitabel? As the... Flapper said to the minister, Buster, there ain't enough.
So you're writing a book. What else?
That's it right now.
That's
the book.
It.
The book is my project. I do a column monthly for Car and Driver. I did my first column in Car and Driver in December of 1962, and now I'm back doing a column in Car and Driver and enjoying it a lot. Eddie Alterman, who is now the editor, was a college intern for me and was easily one of the brightest, most inventive, and most unpredictable guys I ever had on my staff. It was just a pleasure to have him in an editorial meeting, even as an intern.
Hey, David Welch is joining us.
Hey, sir.
The David Welch is joining us.
Yeah. The?
The.
Title?
Chose an
yeah.
outfit to go with the dog.
Yeah. You can get Ike's stamp of approval.
But Eddie has done a good job, I think, initially of taking hold of that magazine and starting to remold it somewhat in his image. And he called me, and I'm delighted to be doing a column there. It's like going back to a bunch of old friends. My reader mail is fun because there are guys who tell me that they haven't read me in 35 years, and it's really nice to have me back.
What do you make of what's going on in the whole enthusiast press thing? I mean, you started at Road and Track, right?
Yes, 1957.
Then you went to Car and Driver.
Well, I went to Campbell Ewald and did Corvette ads for 3 years.
Right.
And then I got tapped by Ziff Davis Publishing and went to New York and ran Car and Driver for...
Forever?
Well, no, I was in and out. Okay. As a matter of fact, we were talking about BMW a moment ago. I did the BMW story on the first 2002 that we got to drive. And in that story, I said that the Blaupunkt radio could not pick up a Manhattan station from the other end of the George Washington Bridge. And the vice chairman grabbed me and told me that my next column would be an apology to the Blaupunkt people. And I said, no, it'll be an apology to the Blaupunkt people if you write it, but I'm not going to write it. And he fired me. And I went back to Campbell Ewald and served as creative director there for several years and had just a wonderful time. But I saw that my stories were getting older, and the great stuff that used to happen on the magazine wasn't happening. And as much fun as an advertising agency creative department is, it's still not as much fun as what we do every day.
Certainly for you in running a Car and Driver then. And
yeah.
Then you ended up leaving there.
I went back.
Can your ass too another time, or what happened?
Back at Car and Driver?
Yeah.
No. The CBS people bought it, and I was speaking at a sales convention they were having down around Amelia Island somewhere, and they sent one of their apparatchiks up to the speaker's table and a guy leans over my shoulder and he said, "We'd really appreciate it if you don't say anything about the lawsuit." And I said, "What lawsuit is that?" And he said, "Well, we're suing your former boss, Bill Ziff, for fraud and misrepresentation because we feel we paid too much for the magazines we bought." And I thought, geez, what about Caveat Emptor? And what about the fact that I don't like these guys anyway? And CBS was enough empty suits to start a pretty nice men's clothing operation. And I got on a plane. I wrote a letter of resignation. My wife picked me up here at the airport. I showed her the letter. She read it, and she said, "This is what you want to do?" And I said, "Yeah." So I then got dupes of Frankie Valli singing Don't Think Twice and sent them to all the executive vice presidents of CBS, of whom there were many in those days. And so I sent my letter of resignation along with my dupe of Frankie Valli singing Don't Think Twice. You just kind of wasted my precious time, you know. And started Automobile Magazine for Rupert Murdoch.
Tell that story, because it isn't pretty interesting, pretty unique how you had a meeting with Murdoch at his office in New York?
Yep.
How did that go?
I got a call from him at 7 o'clock in the morning on a Friday when I had just about reached a point where I was desperate. It was pretty clear I was never going to find another job, and I had quit without making any kind of arrangements for my future.
Achy.
That's all right.
He likes the story.
Yeah, well, he should. And so I went into New York and spent 14 minutes with Rupert Murdoch. And he described the deal and said that he'd always wanted to have Car and Driver. And when he bought a bunch of magazines from Ziff Davis, he got the trade books and didn't get the special interest magazine. So he said, "Now I hear that you're available. Would you like to work for me either as an employee or on a joint venture and do another car magazine?" So I started Automobile, and it turned out to be a ferociously successful launch because not only did I have an awfully good crew, but Rupert really worked hard at his end with his people to make sure that the magazine got an awful lot of first-year exposure. And I think we probably had the best magazine launch that year, and it was a bad year. And we did fine. And that was just glorious. It was terrific fun. And then Mrs. Jean Jennings, the former Jean Lindemood, was my protege. I had brought her in from Chrysler, where she was a welder in the crash lab. And that was at the suggestion of her brother. He called me and said, he said, you're the only person I know crazy enough to hire my sister, and I'd like you to talk to her. So I hired Jean, and she was a big success and made a big difference in the texture of the audience. You could see it happen. The first time she appeared in the magazine, you could see that something had happened in the reader mail that was different. And she got impatient after she got married and got me canned. And I sometimes dream of a FedEx flight on its way to Memphis, flying over Parma, where she lives, and a grand piano falling out of the airplane and kind of whistling down through the air, this enormous object, and lands on her and makes the damnedest chord anybody has ever heard. It's just a sound of music that has never been heard by the human ear. And the next morning, all they can find...
Well, no, he's not bitter at all.
No, I'm happy as a clam. And I just, you know, some shards of wood and a grease spot and no other trace of Mrs. Jennings.
All righty, then.
Yeah.
How about them Tigers?
Well, hey, this is Autoline After Hours, where the varnish is stripped off and all the truth comes out. And doesn't get much more blunt than that.
Well, I've never told that story in public before, and I thought it was time.
Well, we're glad you chose it here to tell us, David.
That's good. That's what this show's about.
That is what the show's about, is getting to the unvarnished truth. But, so David Welch, what are you working on these days?
He can't say.
I'm going to dig it out of him one of these shows.
It's actually pretty quiet.
It was kind of a slow news week, although...
You know, sales and the post-clunker hangover.
What'd you make of that?
And all of that.
What's your read on it?
No, look, now Edmunds.com has been down on this thing from the start, but they're saying, the first week after it's over, an 8 million SAR for the week and 9 million so far after that.
Come on, they're going for headlines in saying that, because if you read their fine print, they say, hey, this is early in the month. and they say it'll probably improve, which it will.
My take on this whole thing is it did help sell some cars, some of which were incremental, not enough to really drag anybody out of the muck. You're going to have some kind of hangover. Is it as big as Edmund says? I don't know. Is it small like some of the analysts say? Don't know that either. We'll find out in a month or two. It's not exciting enough for me to want to rush a judgment on that. It's, there's a hangover after every spiff. There just is. And then, when we'll get to some normal level that, Ford and GM are saying, it's going to grow to 10.5 million units in the fourth quarter. Big deal. It's still trouble. So
thanks, Ben.
This whole story on the clunkers thing to me was incredibly overblown. And frankly, I fed it because our readers couldn't get enough of it. I mean, the mail, the comments, the page views on the website, they love the damn story. I mean, I wrote a basic sales story about the clunker hangover off of the news on Tuesday, and it was the number one story on Yahoo. And one of my friends called me. I'm driving home from work in the car. He said, congratulations, you got the number one story on Yahoo. And I thought it was something maybe I wrote like a cover story I did a couple months ago, that they were just occasionally Google or Yahoo will dredge something up, and a month or a couple weeks after, and as
shows
a feature
how important headlines are.
Now, I know, and I said, well, which one was it? He goes, what's the thing about sales and the clunkers? I said, are you kidding me? So they couldn't get enough. But anyway, you look at the total economic impact of it and what it really means. You basically have a bump in sales for 6 or 7 weeks, and then it goes a little bit below normal, and then it gets back to normal, and then on we are, hoping for the economy to turn around.
What'd you make of it, Peter? I mean, not just the clunkers thing, but, you know, you read anything into what we learned about sales and all that, what's going on?
Well, I still remain troubled by the fact that the American consumer is still only equating American car, considering American cars with a deal. You know,
although Toyota did better out of this than anybody, so you know there's some.
But I mean, I'm just
horse
saying,
trading in their dealerships too.
Well, they spent the most money, didn't they?
I take issue with that because if you go on a percentage basis, and I don't compare to a year ago because I say a year ago is another la la land world. You know, it doesn't exist anymore, especially in how much the market's changed in the last year. So to me, what's more important is month-to-month gains. So what happened in July? What happened in August? You know, one-month change, what happened? And in that basis, Honda and Nissan saw bigger percentage gains in total than Toyota. General Motors had a bigger percentage gain than Toyota. Ford and Chrysler, less so.
You're talking total sales.
Total sales.
I'm just talking Toyota had the biggest share of clunker sales, right? Wasn't it 18 or 19%?
Well, you know, GM? That's not what Edmunds says. And we need to see the dust settle and get all these vouchers or whatever is hanging out there in and officially counted. We might have to wait for R.L. Polk to show the real registrations months from now. But I'm not sure what's going on. The numbers are all over the place now.
Well, anyway, what I'm saying... what I was going to say...
It better not be a deal if you want to be a sustainable car company.
Well, right? Yeah. I mean, here are... Well, some of the American car companies have some very worthwhile products to consider, but I'd love to get the American consumer to consider them on their merits rather than just another deal. And even though cash for clunkers included everybody, including the imports, I'm just afraid that for most, too many Americans, it's still about the deal when it comes to considering an American car. And they're missing out on some good cars, but boy, it's going to take a while.
Well, in this economy, you're going to get that, though. I mean, a lot of people are sitting on the couch and they're not going to buy unless there's a great deal out there. There's, you know,
depends on the car.
We've seen a lot of news the past week and a half or so about the economy bouncing, and I don't know. You know, then we saw some bigger jobless data coming out again. So, the job market's not there yet. It's always a lagging indicator. I get that. And it's going to be this time. I think it's going to be really lagging this time. Just, you know, what I've been saying on this show for, you know, a month now is that we're going to crawl and then walk out of this recession. And it's because the job market's going to take so long to recover. We have 10% unemployment. And we have unemployment in some sectors that pay pretty good money. Manufacturing being the obvious one, automotive being the other obvious one, and not just the blue collar auto jobs, you know, the white collar auto jobs too. So, you know, until we get people back to work, until we start to see some wage growth, you know, I don't see any kind of big bounce.
Yeah. And David E., what do you make of the whole cash for clunkers and all that?
Yeah, it's Lee Iacocca and buy a car, get a check, the Dodge Carnival of Values, the annual Toyota sale where people rush back and forth across the showroom with big smiles on their faces. And if all the genius horsepower that we've put together in Washington to run the automobile business, the best idea they can have is a tent sale, for God's sake. I promise you that this time next year, there will be dealers who never got a check and are still trying to get their money.
They say up to 17% of them have been paid now, I think.
I still heard today like 6%. But, what are the numbers really? Because I don't even think the DOT knows.
No, the government's hired 5,000 people to process.
Oh, my God.
They just announced
that. Oh, my God.
To process 5, the form.
Yeah.
And they're assuring that it will be all done by the end of this month.
Well. And to think they fired Rick Wagner.
5,000? We haven't hired that much people back to build the cars to fill the inventory that got sold out.
I know.
Well, it's okay to pad the ranks of the UAW. It's okay to pad the ranks of government workers. But right now, we're way too busy to get any of these normal people back to work. Let them sell their damn snowmobiles and their boats and give up their second homes, and they'll learn.
How about the implosion of Cerberus?
Oh, yeah. Now the shareholders are saying, hey, give me my money back.
71% of them want their money out. Boy, talk about flame out of gigantic proportion.
Well, you know, I were talking about this earlier in the week. I mean, you know, private equity is, first off, obviously they weren't the smart money.
Not as smart as they thought they were.
Cerberus was the second bidder on Chrysler to do really piss-poor due diligence and get left holding the bag. Now, I understand the economy got worse and all of that, but, you know, there were people I knew who were, you know, doing consulting for Cerberus when they were doing their due diligence who were telling me that Cerberus thought the company had great product. They just, you know, needed to restructure and conserve cash. And I thought, great product? Are you kidding me? I mean, nothing's recommended by Consumer Reports. They garish designs, you know, quality issues. I mean, the company doesn't have a great product line.
One of the guys that went in there as a consultant, they called me and asked me if I could get his telephone number, and I found him in Florida and put him together. And I talked to him 2 weeks later and said, how's it going? He said, I'm out of there. I was only there for a few days. And I said, what happened? And he said, it's the most testosterone-driven operation I've ever had in my life. And he said, it's all about the deal. And he said, to see these grown guys in their expensive suits leaping out of their chairs and high-fiving one another every 35 or 40 minutes because somebody called them back and it's really hot. He said, it's not the real world. It's not business. It's something I don't understand.
But they sure paid themselves handsomely.
Oh, well. And they continue to pay themselves handsomely.
They were majestically ill-equipped for the car business.
Well, I said all along when they came in that this industry was going to chew them up and spit them out.
I did, too. And I got blasted on the website for doing it.
Henry Kaiser returns.
The story I did when they initially bought in, when the deal was final, the headline was Cerberus's lowball strategy. And basically, I compared what they were doing with Chrysler to what Carlos Ghosn did with Nissan. Now, some people debate, you know, is Ghosn really that good and all that? It doesn't matter for the purposes of this discussion, because what Renault did when they bought the controlling stake in Nissan is they brought $6 billion in there. Nissan had cool cars on the drawing boards. They had stuff in design that was good. They just couldn't afford to tool it up. They were going broke. So Ghosn goes in there, plows $6 billion in to get all these products to market, sells off a bunch of parts companies, dealer chains, and a bunch of junk in Japan that was losing money. And, you know, they took a book loss on it, but it generated cash for more new product and technology. Suddenly, Nissan has this blitz of new cars, and what do you know? Who would have thought that a car company that puts out a whole bunch of new product, some of which was even really good, might just succeed and start making real money? That was the brilliance of it. And then you have Cerberus taking over Chrysler. They bring no money in. They refuse to give any more money, and they cut the product budget, and they cut the marketing budget. You know, it's all typical financial engineering, which is, you know, I'm convinced is what Wall Street is all about these days. Create derivatives, create deals to pay somebody, but you don't actually come up with a business plan that's going to make and sell products and turn around, you know, and generate greater cash flow to make more products and keep that cycle going, which is what
Honda. None of those guys, and in fact, unfortunately, a lot of executives in this industry don't realize this is a fashion business. This is an entertainment business. This is about meeting people's emotional needs with this machine called the automobile. And yeah, it's got to have quality, and it's got to meet crash standards and fuel economy and all that. But the real successful ones recognize a car for what it truly is. It's meeting people's expectations. They're dreams. That's the key, I think.
The really good ones don't hire Bob Nardelli.
Yeah, that was just disastrous. I mean, let's face it, if we want to get off the car business, this country has to get back to building things. Mm-hmm. And in Wall Street and in the financial community, they're not really, really well suited to actually making things,
Think about what else private equity does, too. If they buy, the private equity deals in this town that we're most familiar with, you know, blowing up with Chrysler and GMAC. GMAC had a lot of other problems related to mortgage, but is private equity good for buying industrial companies or banks? And I say no, because what they do is they come in and they put a bunch of debt on the operating company's books, And in return, the operating company, in this case Chrysler, gets the fabulousness of Cerberus Operations Group, which is this, I think, two or four hundred strong group of consultants that's part of Cerberus. And they give advice and all this sort of thing. And they do have some ex-car guys in that group, but it's also a lot of GE guys and obviously Nardelli. So they also pay management fees from Chrysler to Cerberus for these guys. But they put all this debt on the books, which charges interest. Now, any kind of capital in a car company or a finance company that's not doing work is basically wasted capital. I mean, you're paying interest on it. If you're a bank and you're putting money on the books and you're not loaning it back out to make money, it's wasted capital. It's just debt on the books. If you're a car company and the capital isn't machines or people that are making something, then, you know, you're just adding interest payments. And that's what's been killing Detroit for the longest time. There is health care, there is pensions, but they all had too much debt. And they had too many interest payments and too many cash calls that cut into the product budget, and they all fell behind. So Cerberus comes in, puts debt on the books. Great plan.
Wasn't it Nance who came to Chrysler and brought the gospel of Wall Street that you guys are spending way too much time
on? Yeah. Packard.
He was at Packard, and he went to Ford.
I believe he did go to Ford after that.
And
he was
then,
the Frigidaire?
I don't know. I'm hazy on the details.
He was at Packard,
and I believe he went to Ford.
Well, there was somebody who came to Chrysler from Wall Street and sold them on the idea that cars weren't where it was at, that it was really, you know, making alliances in Wall Street and setting it up so that the money just rolled in. And
well, remember, Jack Nasser fell for this thing, too, Ford,
right.
Where you know, the Wall Street guys told him, you know, you'll never have a hot stock if you're manufacturing because it's high capital and low margins. But if you buy into dot-coms and dealer chains and all this other stuff that's lower capital and higher margins. And I remember asking Jack in an interview, and I think it was the last one I ever got with him. I said, well, Jack, you know, how many quick fits, it was just a fix-it chain in England that they bought, and dot-coms and junkyards and things do you need to buy to dilute $140 billion in car sales? And he said, well, this is a long-term play. 50 years? It went over like a lead balloon.
Yeah, right. Well, Jack took a perfectly good company and he broke it, although he had a lot of good ideas. And, you know, his whole focus was to capture what he called the total vertical. He wanted the total vertical. But you got to keep building great cars and trucks to have all these fantasy dreams that pay for the whole, you know, way of doing things.
Anytime anyone in this business has gotten away from the product, it usually goes all
wrong. They nosedive.
It usually goes all wrong.
It diverts. You got to put some money to either acquire those businesses or invest and grow them, and that takes money away from the product plan. It takes executive time and focus away from the product and marketing and building the brands. You know, it's just a huge distraction, whether it's financial or management, it just pulls them away from what they should be doing.
Yeah.
David, what do you think, David E., of everything that Detroit's gone through? I mean, you bring a great perspective to this all, and it's gone through a bloodbath. And, I mean, the whole global auto industry has been hurt, but especially here in town. What are the prospects going forward as you see it?
The thing that's happened here this time is totally different from what's happened here in the past. And this is like the decline and fall of the British automobile industry. The British automobile industry got into trouble, needed money, had to revamp in a big way. And they came up against a very nasty, very angry labor government in Great Britain that wanted to see them fail. They were run by a bunch of ruthless capitalists. The labor government wanted to crush those guys. And in the process of crushing them, they crushed their own industry, and it never recovered. It never came back and became a real industry. It was always bandages on awful wounds.
And all those companies were sold to a company in another country, except for, you know, I think Morgan.
Yeah, and now we've...
Which refuses to change.
Yeah. Still
they're still
up.
In the Stone Age when it comes to making cars.
That's right.
But still in business.
But
they do make cool cars.
But that's where we are right now. We have a hostile government that is determined to take over this industry, And I think that they could truly screw the pooch. I think that we could just watch the thing gradually disintegrate.
Yeah, it's definitely teetering.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're at a very pivotal point. I'm actually kind of optimistic myself because I look at what Mulally's doing at Ford, and it's for real. Oh, this isn't luck.
He's the exception.
And I like some of the stuff I see happening at GM. I think, as I've said all along, GM's got a sales problem, not so much a marketing or a product problem. I think the product coming out ever since Lutz gotten the full cycle of things there, that the stuff coming out is absolutely world-class competent. But I'm intrigued by, you know, Fritz and the management team went to the board and said, we recommend you buy or sell Opel to Magna. And the board went, no, go get a better deal. Yeah. And I'm encouraged to see the board really starting to challenge management. I think that's a very good sign.
Yeah.
And I'm also intrigued by what I see at Chrysler. Marchione, this guy doesn't mess around. This guy doesn't waste any time doing anything but working. He is a workaholic. He's expecting a lot from his people. He did pull off a very impressive turnaround at Fiat, and he's applying the exact same lessons that he learned there to Chrysler, which involves a new management structure, which I like, that really goes for decentralization.
It also focuses on brand. And everything goes up to the brands.
Right. And, you know, first thing they announced, we're not killing the Viper. And so I'm encouraged. I see this whole bloodbath that we've been through of getting rid of the legacy costs, get rid of the jobs bank, all that other nonsense that we had. I'm hoping, but I do believe we're on the verge of seeing Detroit finally being competitive for the first time in my career.
The thing is, I agree with everything you say about Marchione, but is he sort of walking into this thing under a falling knife? I mean, you know, can he really turn it around?
It might be too late. It might be. I don't say he's going to turn it around, but I like what I see. And I know people deep in the bowels of the organization. So I'm not talking management people who think when they talk to me they have to say positive things. I'm talking about people deep in the organization who say, it's a lot more fun and a lot more progressive working with Fiat than it was with Daimler. They see real progress being made. So I'm kind of encouraged, just to give a balance to what some of you guys have said.
Fiat has to undo the damage that Daimler-Benz did, and then they've got to build something new on top of that. And I guess I wish they hadn't started by sending the Topolino to Mexico. That's not really reassuring. It's hard to get their guys to go over the top and march into the guns when Topolino is going to be built in Mexico.
Plus, they have to figure out a way to survive for the next 22 months.
It's going to be not easy.
With what, the new Grand Cherokee?
Right. And new 300.
And then refurbished 300.
And new interiors and existing stuff.
Right.
But all that'll do is get us to stop bitching about how bad their interiors are. That's not what makes people run into the showroom, that the Dodge Caliber has a new and good interior finally. Well, that's great, but that's not what gets people to go to the showroom.
No. The fallback scenario is it's the greatest Fiat North America one could ever imagine.
Yeah. That's I don't understand what happened to Jim Press. I've known Jim Press for an awful long time, and I have believed that he is probably the second best guy with dealers in my entire experience, that Lee Iacocca was the only guy who could get the dealers to stand up and, you know, march into the guns. And Jim had this incredible warmth, incredible ability to communicate with them. They respected him. They trusted him at Toyota, less so at Chrysler, because he got blamed, I think, for a lot of stuff that was essentially structural.
Well, I think he did threaten the dealers at one point when they were trying to get them to take more inventory, and that really soured. With Jim, you know, he's a good marketing guy, and he's a very good dealer guy. But, you know, the question I was asking when he took the job is, if you take Phil Jackson and watch him win the NBA title with Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen and company, and then you watch him win it again with Shaq and Kobe Bryant, and then you give him today's New York Knicks, is he going to win the NBA championship? And that's sort of the equivalent here. You take a guy who won with Toyota, you know, a company that was just on an unbelievable hot streak when Jim was there, and then you send him to Chrysler, which is one of the sickest companies in the business with a weak product line. And he couldn't do much without a product line either.
Not to mention he, you know, clashed with Nardelli from the get-go, and that was never going anywhere good.
Right.
Well, you know what happened?
Absolutely
is
right.
That was another big blunder by Cerberus, because they hired press, and they didn't tell Nardelli they were doing it. And they just sort of called him up.
Is that right?
That's what
How do you not tell
that.
The top guy that you're hiring big gun in the industry?
They basically told him, we're hiring him. They didn't say, you know, why don't you talk to this guy? Why don't you see if you get along with him and if you like him? And, you know, Nardelli had a, you know, a big ego about him, obviously. And you know, they clashed on, you know, basically how much media time he was getting. And Nardelli didn't love the media, but he didn't want to be sort of in anyone's shadow when he was the CEO either. And, you know, I've heard those stories from PR about how, you know, Bob didn't like press getting all the media. So, yeah.
Well, look, it was an ugly situation. You know, Cerberus bought this thing for very little money, really, and even less of their own money. Obviously, they put up everybody else's money. They didn't really know what they were getting into. They thought they were going to show these Midwest hicks run a business.
Absolutely.
They had no idea how much cash this business chews up and spits out, as it was soon going to do with them. Somebody told them, oh, you should hire Jim Pross. He's really good with dealers. And they realized the dealers hate Nardelli. They don't connect with him at all. Okay, buy this guy. Mm-hmm. Throw a bunch of money at him. Yeah. Make him walk away from this brilliant career he's had at Toyota. So he comes in, and he's trying to do his thing. But like you guys say, they're both going off in different directions. They don't gel at all. And then on top of that, the whole global economy collapses.
Yeah.
And that's what everybody's got to realize. I mean, if the global economy didn't collapse, Rick Wagner would still be chairman of General Motors. You know, the Cerberus thing might they might have pulled it off. Who knows? They might have pulled it off. And then, boy, if you think that these, you know, investment guys are a problem now, imagine if they had pulled this thing off. But, you know, everything that could possibly go wrong went wrong. And I feel actually sorry for Jim Press. I think that it's a terrible way for him to ride off into the sunset, you know, with this just mess lying here behind him. I don't envy him.
Yeah, no.
You know, it almost happened that way, though not to the degree for Lutz, though. I mean, you know, he was going to retire at the end of the year because he didn't like government ownership and a few other things about that deal. And, you know, suddenly things change and he decides to come back as vice chairman. He's, you know, hadn't even headed to the door yet. And he comes back to, you know, basically be the number two guy at GM.
Mm-hmm. What about Wagner? And what about Fritz? Was there a net gain when they fired Wagner, or was there a net loss?
I'll tell you, and I've talked about this on the show, though, many months ago. I talked to a guy, fairly senior level manager at GM, who's not at GM, who worked for both of them overseas and in the American market, who told me Rick Wagner can't hold a candle to Fritz Henderson. So I know both guys. I've respected both guys, but I sort of filed that away because here's somebody that I figured ought to know. And, you know, he wasn't trying to aggrandize himself, and maybe I'd put in a good word to Fritz that, hey, guess what? This guy told me. No, he had already left the company. And there's no question that Fritz did extremely well in the old GM system. Mm-hmm. The real question is, and Peter, you and I have talked about this, is Fritz really the right guy now?
Yeah.
And, you know, what I've said is, I'm not convinced he is. I'm not convinced he isn't. This is a whole new company. It's a whole new ball game. And you can't go, I don't think, by his past record in the old GM because this is a different company now. So I'm just, I don't know. Is Fritz the right guy?
Yeah, we're not going to know for a while. Well, the question is, will he be given enough time to prove?
Treasury says they're going to give him the time.
I don't think it's Treasury's decision. I think it's jingle jangle
Ed Whitaker.
And this guy don't mess around. Yeah, they didn't pull him look like an idiot.
Do you really think that Whitaker could just sort of line up the board and fire him without calling somebody in the Treasury Department?
Here's my question. What about Lutz? You know, it's very interesting. Lutz says, hey, I'm going to retire. I've done my gig and I'm out of here. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, I changed my mind. And I don't think that's what happened.
I don't think he changed his mind ever. I think that he never wanted to go. I think he was fiercely angry when he had a sort of Dutch uncle conversation with somebody that turned sour, and he wound up on the short end of the deal. And I would be very surprised to learn that Lutz has changed his mind.
I think you and I know about the same conversation.
Conceivably, yeah.
But I guess you guys don't want to elaborate on that, eh?
No, that's one I can't burn a guy.
But I got to believe that the GM board said, God forbid, what if Fritz steps off the curb tomorrow and gets hit by a bus? Mm-hmm. Who's going to run the company? And somebody must have said, why don't you ask Bob to stick around?
Yeah. Well, the one thing I do know is that the guys in the task force do like Bob a lot. They think he's a guy who's smart and has real product and real consumer sense. You know, people in this town will debate how much consumer sense he has and, is he in touch, is he out of touch? But he does know how to make good cars. And, the issue with GM management has always been that, people go to U of M or Michigan State, then they get their Harvard MBA, and then they become a financial analyst, a junior analyst in the New York Treasury office, and they work their way up. That's where all of these guys came from, including Fritz. And that's, Troy Clark, who was there, he's gone now, but a lot of these guys came up, through that same kind of pedigree, and they would run operating jobs in the regions to sort of get out of just finance, but that's what they did. And you really didn't have, ready to take over jobs in top management, guys who are marketers or engineers or designers or anything like that. And Bob's really the only guy with sort of a different skill set who is up in the upper echelons of management that they could tap. Getting someone else from the outside to come in with the kind of pay they're offering and the scrutiny of this board is going to be tough. I mean, any good CEO should not be bothered by a tough board. But this board, I think, has more pressure than any to be tough. One, they're taking over for a board that nobody respected. And they actually, I think, have to go the extra mile in terms of scrutinizing the company to not look like it's business as usual. Because remember, there are 13 members of the board. Six of them are carryover. They happen to be newer board members and good board members, but they're still carryover. So the public's going to, this is business as usual if these guys aren't tough. Second of all, it's taxpayer dollars. They're going to be in a fishbowl even more than a publicly traded company. Because if you're a publicly traded company, shareholder gets angry, they can sell the stock. The taxpayers are stuck with this until such time as it turns over. So we're all going to be watching, and we're all going to be angry, and bailouts are unpopular, and this deal was unpopular. So these guys have a lot of pressure. I'm talking about the board. So you bring in a new executive, he's got to live with that. He's got to live with potential government intervention. The company is in rough shape still, and the money's not that good. Where do I sign up for that?
I've got a story that I can name names. Pete Estes, when he was president, asked me if I would go to Europe and try to put together a report on the importance of transverse engine front drive. And I said, certainly, and prepared myself to go. And then he called me up and he said, I want you to do something else for me. He said, I see on your list here that you're going to be in Munich. And I said, yeah. And he said, I want you to talk to Bob Lutz and ask him why, when I spoke to him about coming to General Motors instead of leaving BMW and going to Ford, he didn't do it. We never heard anything from him. So I met Lutz in the lobby at the Fyriar at Seiten, and he came in on a motorcycle on the rainiest night in the history of Germany, and he comes into the lobby of the Fyriar at Seiten in motorcycle leather, soaking wet, and flops down on the couch, and I ask him the question. And he said, that's interesting. He said, Pete did offer me a job, and he asked me how much I had to have, and I told him, And he was going to get back to me, and he never got back to me. I never heard any more from him. And so I went back, and I go up to the 14th floor. I report to Pete, and I tell him what Lutz said. And Pete couldn't keep a secret to save his life. And he says, "Oh, God, Dave, oh, Jesus." He says, "That's absolutely true. That's exactly what happened." He said, "I'm so ashamed of myself." He said, I asked him what he had to have, and he wanted as much as we were paying the Pontiac general manager. And I couldn't take that to the board. And I just never did anything. I just let it slide. And he says, "He's absolutely right."
That's pretty good.
Oh, dear.
That's back when general managers had power and money and prestige and all that.
Hey, we ought to get our rapid-fire questions out here. But Ben also had me look on Autoblog right now. There's a report that says Johan Denison, who runs Audi of America, calls the Chevy Volt a car for idiots.
I know Johan very well.
Slams electric vehicles. So, yeah.
You go, Johan.
Well, Johan's one of our friends. We like him a lot.
Savaged by the green blog.
Oh, well, that's okay. I mean, I like Johan.
He's very smart. There's something very interesting right now. You have Jim O'Donnell at BMW, who's not afraid to speak his mind, and Johan really is. I mean, you know, usually, interviewing the marketing guys or the top local guys for the German companies is they're on their best behavior in this sort of thing. And it's sort of boring. These two guys, they'll talk and really just kind of speak what's on their mind, say some interesting things. It's good stuff.
Right.
Well, car for idiots is even Lutz doesn't say stuff that outrageous. At least he hasn't in a long time.
Is there anybody sitting here right now who believes that that car is going to be a home run?
No. But I've said I'd like to get one. I'm serious. I'd like to get a Volt.
I only believe in electric cars in severely limited use situations, and it's not the panacea. It's not the greatest thing since sliced bread. It's going to be part of our transportation fleet going forward, but that's it.
It'll be a niche because the big thing, when we had Nancy Gioia here, who's, in charge of all that stuff at Ford, she really hammered home. I mean, we talked all about the product, but she really hammered home. The utilities have a mega role to play in this, and they do want to step up to it, but the thing is, where are you going to plug in? It's not as everyone thinks, I'll go to my garage and I'll plug in. Okay, that's your garage.
You know, we talked about in Manhattan. What about the opposite street parking days? People aren't going to be able to own them.
You're talking about an industry here where companies struggle to make money on a compact car, and they don't make much on a family sedan. And suddenly you want to take a car that's roughly that size and throw in a battery that's going to cost anywhere from $9,000 to $18,000, plus a bunch of power electronics and motors that need rare earth metals that are certainly scarce.
That's another story we should have talked about.
The
right.
Chinese government sitting on all the rare earth metals.
Right, right.
Gee.
The rare earth in the Middle Earth, right.
Yeah.
Hey, we've got the rapid fire questions. Ben, let's run the graphic and get to this.
There's no graphic here, man.
I think we got to refresh that. We got an email from Chris Wittrock, who asks a great question here. He says, what was first, 0 to 60 miles an hour or 0 to 100 kilometers an hour? And why were these rates of speed chosen as the standard for acceleration? I think that's a great question.
Before I was born.
Wasn't mile a minute the standard? That was a big deal.
And as far as 0 to 100 kilometers are concerned, it's a natural. It's got symmetry. It's a natural cutoff point for automotive acceleration.
Right.
And then when they started doing it at that level, the cars didn't go a lot faster than 100 kilometers.
Mile a minute, yeah.
But
yeah.
Peter's nailed it. I think the mile a minute was a magic thing for people just coming out of the 19th century going, wow.
Yeah.
Of course, trains had gone that fast. But
not
to have your own mobility go that fast, right?
Huge deal.
That's a great question. Then Pedro Fernandez wrote in. He's got one for you, David. Mr. Davis, when you were in charge of any of the magazines, were you ever coerced or pushed into giving a positive review of a car that was not worth the praise?
Never by a manufacturer, often by my own advertising department.
Right. What do you make of some of the car of the year stuff? I've heard horror stories of how they may have been chosen in the past.
The International Car of the Year troubles me a little. I was on that jury for 1 year, and the cars came sporadically. It was kind of unplanned, and a car would show up, but you wouldn't have any time with it. You'd have to stop what you were doing and go drive the car and get it back and then think of something to say about it. And I just don't think that those cars are being very well evaluated, that it's more a matter of personal prejudice and how you feel about the management on one thing than it is a focus on that product.
In one of the columns, early columns I did on the site, I recanted the story about how we as an agency, when I was ECD at BBDO, we had to present to Robert Brown and Motor Trend what we would do if we won the Motor Trend Car of the Year. The whole thing was just a total marketing, advertising deal.
I don't think it's that way.
This is 1980.
This is the past.
This is 1986, yeah. 7.
Wow, that's still pretty recent.
That's still recent.
That's still very recent.
They were...
In fact, that was... I lived that era, and they were denying that was happening at that time.
Yeah. I can attest how much my group spent time, money, effort, storyboards, ads to present to these guys to say, okay, well, I guess we'll let you be Car of the Year.
Every automotive agency in town can tell you stories about the Motor Trend presentation where they came in and suggested amounts that they should get from each division, how the money would be allocated, and one thing or another. 1 year, Chrysler, Ham Shermer was the ad manager, and he was responsible for apportioning the money, and he gave it all to... their outdoor magazine, maybe Guns and Ammo. One of the guys from California flew in and said, boy, we really appreciate the money. It's wonderful to have you. But why did you give it to Guns and Ammo? I said, well, I like the guy who calls on us from Guns and Ammo, and I hate everybody else in the Peterson Publishing Company.
Hey, we got somebody on the line on our Google number that's got a question for Peter. Ben, can we bring that up?
Hey, Dan. I'm watching your AutoLine show, and it's awesome, with David E. Davis. I had a question for Mr. DiLorenzo. Just curious if he really thinks that GM has an eye on building an awesome vehicle lineup, or whether they're just in the market of making money, which has been their MO for so many years. Thanks.
I think GM has been reinvigorated by Bob Lutz, and their products are definitely, in some respects, world class. And now the question is, can they convince the American consumers to look first and to buy? But I think the old days that we're in the business of making money, that's over with.
They've got enough good product, you don't make money.
Yeah, they finally got that.
Incidentally, and in addition to that, I think that the VLEs, I don't know how much Bob Lutz had to do with establishing the VLEs, the vehicle line
that executives. That started before him.
Yeah.
But they have proved to be a real force for good inside the company. They're bright guys. They're highly motivated. They do not behave like old-time General Motors executives. It's really a fresh kind of an operation within General Motors. And I've always thought that they deserved a lot of credit for the good things that have happened in the past few years.
Yeah.
Here, Reno Diggs wrote in to say, a couple of days ago, I saw a Taurus ride and drive at the local Ford dealer, which I thought was a great grassroots sales promotion. Any idea how well this would work for the new GM?
Well, they're doing this sort of thing. I mean, they've got executives out in the field talking to consumers. In fact, I know they're doing it this week.
Well,
Brian Nesbitt at Cadillac was out doing...
Fritz is out in the field every once a month
now. And he is, too. So they're you know, I imagine they've got people driving the cars to get their feedback. So,
yeah.
You know, they're, you know, look, and that's something I don't think you ever would have seen Rick Wagoner doing, is, you know, Fritz out there. And this is something, you know, we're getting a little off the question, but people in GM tell me is that, you know, they say Rick was intellectually stubborn and Fritz will listen. And he looks for ideas. So, you know, he's doing the right things. Is he the right guy? He's got to prove that. But so far, I think he's doing the right things.
Okay, Mud Monster wants to know, Mud Monster 37, just so you don't confuse it with any other Mud Monster. I read some comments on the Cross Tour Facebook page talking about the Honda Cross Tour. He goes, wow, people hate it.
that particular look, this new wave design niche that everyone's beaten to death now, boy, I think it's going to turn a lot of people off. Yeah, I'm all for people need versatility in some cars, but they're just butt ugly, and they're just not. That the 5 Series GT bothers me. It's just
BMW.
Yeah,
right.
I mean, and the Cross Tour, there's just it's a bad design wave.
It's like product development people groping for. What can we come up with? What kind of configuration can we come up with that nobody else has done? Well, nobody else has done it because it's ugly.
Yeah, and all of a sudden they're all doing it.
Right. Well, I like the 5 Series GT. I think it looks great.
Oh, boy.
We'll have it out later.
Okay.
Okay, we got another phone call here from Alan talking about David E's book.
Hey, John. Sure, they mentioned David E. Davis's book, Thus Saith David E. Davis. It's an excellent, excellent read. Best book I think I've ever read. It's Jim Allen out here in Concord, California. He's a small, real exciting writer, and it's an excellent book. Thank you.
The check is in the mail. Wow.
Well, how many? You've written more than one book, have you?
I wrote the first one, Thus Spake David E., which was really a compilation of columns interspersed with fresh material. The next one I want to do is exactly the opposite. I want to do more original stuff interspersed with a few columns. But right now, I'm working on this book about Bud Lyon, a great car collector and a lovely man who's a brilliant scientist and accomplished all kinds of things in his life. And he is unfortunately very ill, and we're trying to pull the book together for his family.
Have you ever written pure fiction, non-automotive stuff?
Why not? Elmore Leonard wants me to write fiction. He says what you do is so difficult. He says you have to sit around and wait for this stuff to happen. He says you write fiction, you sit down and write it. You don't have to wait for anything.
I was in a television studio in a little local thing here, and he was one of the guests before me on this local program thing. And we got to talking, and your name came up because, if you're into autos, you must know David E. And then he gave me this whole lecture on how David E. Davis should do a whole lot more writing that has nothing to do with cars.
Yeah. I went to school with one of Elmore's sons, Peter, and Peter and I are still friends, and I remember being at Elmore's house, and David E. was in the back, and we were standing around the garage or something. It was Peter, myself, Elmore, and David E., but, you know, we disappeared so David E. and Elmore could talk and have a cocktail.
Well, he's a wonderful friend. He was actually my mentor at Campbell Ewald. They just walked me down the hall and said, Dutch, this is the new writer, and we want you to sort of look after him. And it turns out it's Elmore Leonard.
Okay, we got a comment here from Todd McGlynn. He says, how quickly can Fiat bring their cargo van to the NAFTA market now that Dodge has no Sprinter?
I don't know. That's a question for Sergio.
Yeah.
Well, they're saying that they can, not that specific product, but they're saying that they can get stuff in 18 to 24 months here. Mm. I mean, 24 has generally been what they're saying, but I'm hearing 18 for the 500 and, you know, a little under 24 months for the other products. And they're even working with the same parts companies to get them to just tool up over here so they can just start, you know, making parts for the cars. So Sergio will get it done fast.
Well, you know, Fiat's got a commercial truck division called Iveco. Mm-hmm. And Iveco has a van called the Daily that is very, very similar to the Sprinter. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure they discussed this many months ago. David E., John in Texas wants to know, tell us your thoughts about the latest Ford Lincoln vehicles and where you see Ford sitting 5 years from now.
When I first heard about this current crop of Lincoln product, I didn't expect much. It seemed to me like they ran into terrible trouble just trying to explain why they were named what they were named. And you got the feeling that there were whole
MKS,
groups.
MKX, yeah. MKT, all that nonsense,
yeah.
Right.
And that somebody ran afoul of somebody and all that, and they had to change everything. But it's an odd group of names, and it's hard to explain it to people. But the cars themselves are pretty remarkable. I would say right now, that Ford has 8, 10, maybe even a dozen really first-rate cars out there, and it's they're kind of sleepers. Whether it's their advertising approach or what, I'm not sure how many people in the United States really know how good the Ford product has become.
So clearly more are finding out because their sales are...
But you know what I think the problem is? For the most part, for the particularly Ford brand, and this is very subjective, but I think their design is pretty boring.
I'd agree with you.
I think GM has better design.
I would agree.
And more eye-catching design.
I think Ford truck is not so bad, but Ford pass car North America, they got to pick up their game.
That new Lincoln big crossover is nice, though.
MKT.
Wonderful driver.
Yeah. I haven't driven it.
Oh, it's a super driver.
Oh, man. I mean, it looks like a locomotive to me.
But I like the design because it's got a point of view.
It's different. You know,
go ahead. It reminded me of the old DeSoto Adventurer when I first saw it. And I drove it to New Hampshire to spend a week working with Bud Lyon on this book. And it was wonderful driving across to New Hampshire and back. I just loved it and still do, as a matter of fact.
I got to get in that thing. I know I've got it on the list. Well, we got to wrap it up here, but this is maybe a great comment. It's not a question. It's from Phil Hopewell, who says, "Hello, Mr. Davis." He says, "I applied for a job at Car and Driver way back in 1989. I drove my MGB from Canada down to Ann Arbor, Michigan, and hand-delivered my resume. If only you'd hire me back then, I might be an automotive journalist like you guys right now."
Well, I don't think he handed it to me. I think he probably handed it to the receptionist, and she wasn't doing any hiring that day.
Well, we should wrap up the show. We're at the top of the hour, but as always, Peter, great having you here. I look forward to these nights. It always ends up being good. Oh yeah, and next week I'm going to be out of town. Peter will be hosting the show then.
Bring the tequila.
Bring the tequila. Yeah, the Patron.
Absolutely. I need to say hi to Scotty in Cleveland.
We got to say hello to Scotty in Cleveland. I mean, it's.
I don't even know if he still even listens to the show anymore, or watches the show.
We should also mention anybody can follow us at facebook.com/Autoline Detroit. You can get all kinds of updates and info. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/Autoline, or you can follow Peter at twitter.com/AutoExtremist, or David Welch at twitter.com/DWelch47.
Now, they're better off going to businessweek.com and checking out the AutoBeat blog, because I tweet about once a month or something.
Oh,
like that.
Okay, yeah.
Scott in Cleveland says he always listens.
Scotty,
right, Scott?
You the man.
When are you going to start your new website, Twitter Extremist?
Shiny, happy, smiley Twitter.com.
I'm such a disappointment to the Twitter brigade. I know.
Sucks.
I know. I don't know.
Well, Twitter is crazy if you're just, you know, constantly filling stuff in there. It's a good way of getting stuff out, but yeah. You just don't go nuts about it.
No.
I use it to refer people to the AutoBeat blog, which is what I'm doing here tonight.
Well, yesterday I was driving back from a Subaru lunch to going back to Ann Arbor. and there was a young woman driving along in a the former Malibu, not the this year's, but the earlier one. And she was driving erratically, and I set out to pass her once, and it was clear that that was not going to be a good idea.
She was.
When I finally did get ahead of her, I saw her car take a lurch in one direction and then recover, and I peered into the rearview mirror, and she was up on top of the steering wheel texting. And
it's just crazy.
Yeah.
I'm in this traffic jam on the way here. There's a bunch of construction up on 696.
Yeah.
And I'm watching this woman in an SUV behind me sort of closing in pretty quick as I'm slowing down to stop. And she finally does stop. But once she gets close, I can see, I'm not kidding you, she's got a cigarette out the window in one hand and her cell phone texting away in the other. And I'm thinking, what's holding the wheel?
Yeah. We can talk about that.
Although I got to tell you, I just drove a Volvo XC60, which has got a nav system that you have to use a remote, like a television remote, to operate.
No.
And, I mean, you know, the theory I'm sure the Volvo engineers would tell you is, well, you set your destination and that's that. Well, sometimes you want to zoom in on the map or zoom out on the map. Mm-hmm. You got to pick up this remote and do this stuff. And I thought, this is the same as texting.
But weren't we talking about yesterday about the new Porsche Panamera has the nav right in front of the driver, which
right.
I don't think is a good idea.
I don't either. I think the passenger should be able to access the nav system in a car. There's a lot of times when you're as a driver, whether it's going fast or in really inclement weather, where you really should be paying attention and tell me, look up here, you know, look where do I have to... Your passenger can help. This is why they had riding mechanics way back when in race cars.
My wife,
we had to concentrate on the driving.
We have a TomTom, and my wife puts it in the lower corner of the windshield on her side. And I can see it anytime I want to, and it's the graphics are good enough that I can read it from across the car. And yet, it's not right in front of me, and I can refer to it whenever I want to, but it's not in the way. And I think that's a reasonable arrangement, but it does say something about graphic design that the typography and everything on the TomTom is really makes it very useful.
Readable, yeah.
Very user-friendly.
But Peter makes a great point. I mean, I know what they're trying to do. They're trying to package stuff so you don't have this big, ugly screen, or at least designers might think it's a big, ugly screen. But, yeah, they try to package it into, you know, and I believe Mercedes did that, too. In fact, the Chrysler Pacifica, if I remember right, had the nav packaged into the instrument cluster.
Yes, it did, yes. I actually drove one for a while. I did have.
I thought the first generation Mini did too. Instead of the big speedometer, which is what I have, if you got the nav, I think that's where it was, just to the right of the wheel, right there.
Yeah. Well, David Welch, great having you here.
Thanks, John.
We'll pry out of you one of these days. What some future big story you got coming?
Not just
the stuff that you already wrote that just happened to go to number one on Yahoo News.
Ah, yes. That's my finest work, too.
And David E. Davis, great having you here.
Oh, great. We do a Christmas show and name names. That would be good.
We'll do it.
Our present to the audience.
Well, you know, Bob was going to come on the show, but he said, I'm going to wait till I'm done. You know, this is before his new career at GM, and so now that's probably not going to happen. But
why wouldn't he come on?
He just, you know, he wanted to be out of the company because he wanted to say more, I guess.
He could be looser if he wasn't, you know, one of the senior officers at a major car company talking about the industry.
So let's get Johan in here.
But, apparently he has no problem saying anything.
Well, you know, Bob has had problems in that regard. I don't know what it was like at BMW, but everywhere since BMW, Phil Caldwell called me one day and said that he didn't want me talking to Bob Lutz anymore. And I said, well, that's between you and Bob Lutz. And he said, well, I'm talking to Bob, too. He's indiscreet. He says things that he shouldn't say. But I want you to know that I don't want you talking to him anymore. And I thought, geez, Phil, pay me $1 million a year and you can tell me things like that, but right. But not when I'm just a guy on the end of the on the phone.
Well, goodbye and thanks to everybody. Visit our website, OuterLineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Outerline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Outerline Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at OuterLineDetroit.tv.